We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Eric Reamer for March 21st, 2023. Today, Dr. James Kennedy explains how to guard against non-compliant outpatient ICD-10 diagnosis code reporting. The OIG believes there's potential for fraud. We got the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Tiffany Ferguson reports on the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and the guy who inspired the laughing phrase, "Sock it to me," Chuck Buck.
Whoa, thank you, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 546th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, "Sock it to me." Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
Our good friend Dr. James Kennedy is with us today. He's going to be reporting on potential fraud because of non-compliant ICD-10 diagnosis code reporting. So the OIG believes there could be a potential for fraud. Erica, what is your reaction to all of this?
Well, unfortunately, bad actors can engage in fraud everywhere in healthcare. It's why I always say, practice excellent medicine, document it well and truthfully, and the quality metrics and reimbursement fall where they belong.
Amen. And Erica, that's a very interesting take on that subject. Speaking of which, what are you going to be talking about during your talkback segment today?
I have some more thoughts on topics presented at the Coordination and Maintenance Committee.
Excellent, Erica. Thank you very much. And as always, Erica, we look forward to your talkback segment. We have much news to report, and so we begin with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Chuck, I have titled today's segment, "What Everyone Knows About You." A few years ago, I was giving a presentation to a group of cardiologists. I provided them a schedule for all of the members of the group and how much Medicare had paid them by procedure code for the prior year. I went on to tell them the names of the medical schools they had graduated from and the addresses and phone numbers of all of their offices. I showed them that they had been billing all evaluation and management claims at the highest code level, and that exposed them to the risk of audit. One of the physicians got very angry. He thought I had hacked their computers. He wanted to throw me out and call the authorities. I had to explain to him that all the data I had presented had come from public sources. If you work for a hospital, a nursing home, a home health administration, hospice, federally qualified health center, renal dialysis facility, community mental health clinic, or rural health clinic, then your financial operations, including census data, gross charges, Medicare charges, and Medicare reimbursement, are also public. Back to 1996. If you work for a hospital, then the names and MPI numbers of all of the physicians credentialed with the facility is also public data. If you're a physician or other Part B provider, the amount of money you are paid by the pharmaceutical industry, including speaking fees and debt forgiveness, is also public data. And for physicians, all of your offices, including their addresses and phone numbers, you guessed it, is public data, as well as the school you graduated from, and yes, this is public data too. If you work for a hospital or nursing home, someone can get a list of your Medicare paid claims, theoretically stripped of HIPAA identifiers, as public information. It's important to understand as a provider of healthcare in the United States that you are in the most regulated industry in the world. All providers in the United States should know what information is out there about them and what data is available about their competitors. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert and the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It's Tuesday. It's March the 21st, and you're listening to the 546th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
The social determinants of health, SDOH, are becoming more important every day. CMS is expected to mandate the social determinants assessments and reporting. Are you prepared? Can your organization integrate the collection of social determinants data and Z-codes into staff workflows? During an exclusive ICD-10 Monitor webcast, two of the nation's prominent subject matter experts, Tiffany Ferguson and Marie Steinbuch, will walk you through essential concepts specific to the capture of SDOH data and Z-codes, as well as CMS reporting guidelines and requirements. The webcast, Social Determinants of Health, How to Maximize Data and Z-Code Capture, is April 13th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. To attend, register now at the ICD University Bookstore.
Now is the time for the Talk 10 Tuesday Coding Report. with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica, and hello to our listeners. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month to highlight the importance of screening for colorectal cancer. There are four types of screenings: the fecal occult blood test, or FOBT, colonoscopy, sigmoidoscopy, barium enema, which is an alternative to screening sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of death among cancer. It doesn't have to be, as it is considered to be, a largely preventable diagnosis. The most recent coding clinic on this topic is first quarter 2019, page 33, where the question is about the diagnosis for a screening colonoscopy and abnormal Cologuard test. A fecal polyp was found and removed during the colonoscopy. The advice was to assign K63.5, which is polyp of the colon, as the first listed diagnosis due to the positive finding of the Cologuard test. This procedure would be considered diagnostic and not a screening. The screening diagnosis codes for malignancy are found in the subcategory Z12.1, with the fourth digits of 0 for unspecified, 1 for colon, 2 for rectum, and 3 for small intestine. The diagnosis codes for colorectal malignancy are found in categories C18, C19, C20, and C21, which are also HCCs. The codes for personal history of colon cancer is Z85.038. The code for family history of colon cancer is Z80.0. For CPT, the screening codes are barium enema, G0120, and that's the alternative to a screening colonoscopy, G0106, alternative to screening sigmoidoscopy, and G0122, which is the barium enema. Colonoscopy, G0121 for not a high risk, and G0105 for high risk. Sigmoidoscopy, G0104 for flexible sigmoidoscopy. And the blood-based biomark is G0327. To add a personal spin to this story, last August I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, and it was in the moderate to severe stage. And what is also concerning is that this is a increases my risk for colorectal cancer. Due to my own fears, I had delayed my first colonoscopy, but I had a great experience, and it was the best sleep that I had had in months. My ulcerative colitis is now in remission, and I am managing the disease with Entyvio, and I receive that as a 30-minute infusion every 8 weeks. So I'm here to say, don't delay your screening. Your life could depend upon it. And back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Lori. I was laughing about the best sleep you ever got. I know how you feel. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Lori Johnson, thank you again for that excellent report. And coming up next, Tiffany Ferguson will be reporting on the social determinants of health.
This segment is sponsored by Hitex, a physician-automated CDI query tool for both inpatient and outpatients. It's embedded software in Epic systems, so you know it's excellent. Find them at hitex.com.
Here now is Tiffany Ferguson, and Tiffany also has the Tucked In Tuesday Listener Survey. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, all. So often on our segment, I talk about how and why collecting SDOH data is a value. However, I think this part is actually, for the next part I'm going to discuss, is actually about discussing what's happening with all the data that we've been collecting. What are we learning in healthcare, and how can this drive change? While some organizations are still looking at how to ask the questions, how to incorporate it, as we've talked in previous segments, many tech companies are actually entering the scene and have already figured out how to integrate the behaviors from our phone, the purchases we make, and correlate this with our healthcare data. So Prealize is a San Francisco-based tech firm who partners with health plans, specialty care management companies, healthcare technology, and employers, released a 2023 State of Healthcare Spotlight on SDOH. I'm going to provide the reference of my article out later this week. However, I would say that obtaining this paper does require that you verify you're not a robot. So without going into all the details, I'll say that the report is worth such verification. The report looks at the impact of non-clinical risk factors that intersect with cardiovascular health, behavior health, musculoskeletal health, and maternal health. Unique findings were reported in each area, which highlighted significant factors across various social determinants, and then scaled this impact to the significance it can provide on the patient's disease process. Prealize then assessed if these factors correlated with populations or if there was a variation across Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial health plans. So for instance, some of the findings, populations who had a poor quality relationship with their physician were found to have lower frequency of PCP visits, resulted in greater frequency of cardiovascular disease, and a higher incidence of emergency care utilization. They found that populations living in food deserts were significantly more likely to utilize behavioral health services than those individuals who had more access to food in their communities. Lack of transportation was a significant risk factor across all health domains. What does this mean for the listener? The data you are coding and collecting at your healthcare organization has relevance and meaning for your population and the communities you serve. Although these are generalities we are learning across the country, when it comes to health equities, each community must find a means to address their own unique challenges and how their social determinants, such as lack of food or access to public transportation, are playing a part in their local community so that messaging and interventions can be adjusted appropriately. So for today's listener survey, I ask, has your healthcare organization started reporting on any of the findings related to social determinants of health in your community? Yes, no, unsure, and does not apply. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management. Chuck?
Thank you both, and we're going to have the results of today's Talk to Tuesday listener survey later in this broadcast, but first, this very important message.
Now everyone on your team, whether on-site or remote, can have unlimited access to every interventional, diagnostic, and nuclear medicine coding resource from MedLearn Publishing. Introducing the Comprehensive Radiology All-Access Pass. Today, more than ever, the new Comprehensive Radiology All-Access Pass makes perfect sense. You receive reliable radiology information and instruction. Now for a single subscription fee, a Comprehensive Radiology All-Access Pass gives you unlimited access to every radiology how-to resource in our extensive library, including ebooks, coding charts, live and on-demand webcasts, a monthly newsletter, and blog content. This is the ideal knowledge transfer solution for teams of all sizes. Plus, it's the easiest way to ensure that your team stays current with CEUs from a variety of organizations.
The Inspector General of the OIG, General Christy Grimm, recently issued a call to action. You see, the OIG is concerned about potential fraud as a result of noncompliant ICD-10 diagnosis code reporting. So here now with the response to those concerns is our good friend, Dr. James Kennedy. Good morning, Dr. Kennedy.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, Erica. Thank you for having me here with you. Yes, absolutely. Christy Grimm, the Inspector General of the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services, recently spoke at the RISE Convention regarding their concerns involving outpatient or ICD-10 CM diagnosis coding. They explained a tremendous anxiety and belief that there is substantial fraud, abuse, and waste as it relates to diagnosis coding, which in essence is trickle-down economics in the way that it funds the Medicare Advantage plans. Ms. Grimm was extremely complimentary of the need for risk adjustment, in essence, plans that have the sicker populations need to have the funding in order to care for those populations. But on the other hand, she also spoke very clearly about a number of diagnoses that were submitted by these plans based upon assessments that were done in a patient's home for which the patient did not receive ongoing therapy. For example, mental health conditions was a tremendous risk adjuster in this. Even with many of these mental health diagnoses that did trickle down to the Medicare Advantage plans, there was not any ongoing treatment for those mental conditions in physicians' offices, hospitals, so on and so forth. So what I believe is happening is that Inspector General Grimm is reflecting an anger that is occurring with Med Advantage plans and also any entity that requires risk adjustment. There is going to be a certain amount of passion and anger in addressing this. We all know that the American Hospital Association is angry with Med Advantage plans because of their denials or the fact that they tend not to have the same coverage that one would get in a traditional Medicare plan. This was brought out, the funding of these Med Advantage plans was brought out in an article in the New York Times of October the 8th, 2022, what entitled, quote, "The cash monster was insatiable, how insurers exploited Medicare Advantage, Medicare for billions." And then, of course, we now have a number of lawsuits, of which the Kaiser is now even being investigated. And this is an ongoing investigation, an ongoing suit of the clinical validity, qualification of diagnoses, and, quote, leading queries as it relates to this. So what is an audience member supposed to do? We cannot just admire the problem. I would suggest that everyone go to oig.hhs.gov and read Christy Grimm's lecture. That is available, or you can even watch it. Because I will tell you, members that were in the audience, they got chills down their back. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of personnel being gathered by the OIG to audit diagnosis coding, and as such, we need to prepare. Number two, compliance officers of every organization need to be aware of this and also to have their plan in place in order to prepare for the audits that are sure to come. Remember, with fraud, it is not just intent to deceive, but willful neglect or reckless disregard can be considered to be fraud. And for every claim that has a false code, there's $5,000 to $10,000 of penalty plus treble damages. So every compliance department needs to be involved. If you're a small physician practice, go to the OIG website. They have model compliance plans. Have your accountant, have your biller, have your attorney at least set up a model compliance plan and execute that model compliance plan in order to protect yourself against the allegation of willful neglect or reckless disregard. Number three, I would say that you do need to be paying attention to the fundamentals, which in my mind, the ICD-10 guidelines and the coding clinic are fundamental in order to survive any audits of this. I strongly recommend reading Coding Clinic, third quarter 2019, pages 5-6. Coding Clinic, third quarter 2020, page 30. Coding Clinic, third quarter 2021, page 33. In essence, if a diagnosis is in the record, It can only be coded if it was monitored, evaluated, assessed, or treated. And as such, just because a patient is diabetic, just because the patient's on insulin, those two will not justify the coding of diabetes unless the physician says something like patient's diabetes being treated with insulin, or to some extent that the diabetes was assessed during the stay. So if I go in with a stubbed toe, there's diabetes on the record, diabetes cannot be coded unless it is documented something was being done with this. So what would I do if I was the compliance officer of a practice? Number one, I would absolutely stop the practice of physicians assigning codes that go directly to the biller. I'm a doctor. I have no clue as to how the coding clinic, what the rules are. I don't know the index. I don't know the table. I'm a doctor, as Bones would say in Star Trek, not a coder. My job is to take care of patients. I would say that if physicians do put bills codes in their software, they need to be reviewed by a qualified person before they go out for billing as to ensure that it is compliant with the guidelines, the coding clinic number, and et cetera. Number two, I would start a definitions manual. Clinical validation is absolutely crucial in this area. Without the definitions of the terms, we cannot at least refute the clinical validation concerns that come from the government. And number three, just keep working it, keep sending, and just keep talking about it. And please bring this to us here at Talk 10 Tuesday. That's about all the time I had. Thanks for letting me be here. I turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Jim. That was Dr. James Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is the founder of CDIMD.
Now's the time for the Talk 10 Tuesday listener survey. Once again, here's Tiffany Ferguson.
The question I asked is, has your healthcare organization started reporting on any of the findings related to social determinants of health in your community? And actually about 41% of our listeners said yes. The rest is kind of a spattering. So 10, 11 said no, about 33% said unsure, and about 15 was does not apply. For those of you that said yes, I'd love for you to just, you could comment in the Q&A on some of the things that you guys have learned from the data reporting. It'd be interesting to read and review.
Now's the time for our very popular segment here at Talk 10 Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Good morning, Dr. Reamer. It's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. Last week, my focus was on rare conditions from genetic mutations. This week, I will address some of the other topics from the March 2023 ICD-10 Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting that piqued my interest. A group of trauma specialists brought a request to change the default in the alphabetic index for external causes for documentation of gunshot wound from accidental intent to assault. Their concern is that epidemiological data is skewed because 80% of non-fatal firearm injuries are assaults. The comments on this topic were that the statistics are different for the pediatric population, which have more accidental injuries, and that maybe it shouldn't be limited just to unspecified firearms. Then there was a request for developing codes for hypoglycemia levels. These would be used as adjuncts to any condition which includes hypoglycemia in the code set. Hypoglycemia level 1 is a blood glucose between 54 and 69 milligrams per deciliter. Hypoglycemia level 2 is a blood sugar less than 54 milligrams per deciliter. And hypoglycemia level 3 signifies that the patient is unable to function with mental and/or physical changes due to the low blood sugar. Of course, the coder would not be permitted to make that leap. The clinician would need to document hypoglycemia level 2 or level 3. Codes are being sought for disruption or dehiscence of gastrointestinal tract anastomosis, repair or closure, and disruption or dehiscence or of closure of internal operation, surgical wound, of abdominal wall muscle or fascia. An expansion at T81.3 will accomplish this. AHRQ wants these codes to be able to distinguish these complications. Next, one can assume that patients are not discharged with sepsis, but sepsis survivors have a high risk of readmission or recurrence. Currently, there is no good compliant way to signal to rehab or other follow-up providers that a patient had a bout of sepsis. University of Colorado Health is requesting an encounter for sepsis aftercare code Z51.A. I supported that, but I also suggested that we should create a personal history of sepsis companion code. There was a passionate appeal by a consortium of clinicians, researchers, and patients for a code to indicate Gulf War illness, which is a chronic multi-system illness affecting personnel who served in the Persian Gulf conflict. They proposed Z77.3, contact with and suspected exposure to Persian Gulf theater, but they wanted inclusion terms of Gulf War illness and Gulf War syndrome. One would use additional codes to identify associated manifestations. I do not think that Z77 should be used for both contact exposure and for the development of the syndrome. The typical pattern is that you code contact or exposure before a diagnosis is established, but once a patient has a definitive diagnosis, it supersedes contact or exposure. Think about COVID-19. My comments recommended that there should be a code for the syndrome as well as the contact/exposure code. I also wonder if exposure to burn pits in general should have a code as well. One code set expansion whose time is long overdue is multiple sclerosis phenotypes. They are proposing making G35 a set of four codes, relapsing, remitting, the most common form, primary progressive, secondary progressive, and unspecified. Someone requested an acute exacerbation designation, but I'm not quite sure how they would accomplish that. It was also interesting to me and Linda Holtzman that they used letters instead of numbers. So G35.A will be relapsing, remitting, multiple sclerosis. She beat me to asking, and the response was that it was related to alignment with World Health Organization's ICD-10 code set. They don't want to step on WHO's toes. The last topic I am going to explore with you is obesity classes. You may be aware that an attempt to destigmatize the condition is no longer politically correct to use the term morbid obesity. We are supposed to either use severe, clinically severe, or obesity class 3. Coding Clinic has given dispensation to go to E66.01 if someone documents class 3. They are looking to establish a classification with two different options. I highly recommend you review the code proposals and offer your input. It's great to be part of the system. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. That's an excellent topic for your talk back. Now let's take a look at some of the questions and comments that we've been coming in while we've been on the air, Erica.
Great. Lori, in the outpatient setting, is it appropriate to put screening codes Z12 on the outpatient claim for when a provider is placing an order for the screening?
Yes, it is appropriate to put that order, and understand that when Coding Clinic provided their advice, that there was additional information that was available that the patient did have a history of a positive Cologuard. So that's why they're saying it's no longer a screening because they have signs or symptoms of a condition.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm going to actually say that I'm not entirely sure that that is the most current information, and I'm going to read Ron's question, and then I'm going to read something that I looked up. Did the rules not change so that a colonoscopy after a positive Cologuard could be coded as screening so it gets 100% covered by Medicare? And what happened was, it's a very recent ruling, so Lori, you might just have sort of kind of missed it, but the CMS said that a positive result from a non-invasive stool-based CRC screening test no longer requires that the follow-up colonoscopy be considered a diagnostic colonoscopy. So covered CRC screening tests now include a follow-on screening colonoscopy after a Medicare-covered non-invasive stool-based CRC screening test result returns a positive result. And what they said was, we now understand both the non-invasive stool-based test and the follow-on colonoscopy are part of a continuum of a complete CRC screening, and that patient cost-sharing won't apply to the non-invasive stool-based test and the follow-on screening colonoscopy in this scenario because both are specified preventative screening services. In addition, current statutory limitations on screening colonoscopy frequency won't apply to the screening colonoscopy that follows a positive result from a stool-based test. And what it says is physicians should attach the KX modifier to a screening colonoscopy code to indicate the service was performed as a follow-on screening after a positive result from a stool-based test. So basically, they want to remove the barriers and encourage patients to proceed to the colonoscopy procedure after the positive result from this stool-based test. They don't want finances to be a barrier.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And that is going to be a wrap for our 546th live edition of Talk to Intuition. I want to thank our panelists today, Tiffany Ferguson, Laurie Johnson, Tim Powell, Dr. James Kennedy, who reported our lead story. And a very special thank you to my co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And remember, when you can't listen to us live, you can listen to all the Talk to Intuition broadcasts on Stitcher, Apple, and Spotify. And when you do, give us a review. Until next week, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk to Intuition. Thank you again, everybody, and have a great week.
Talk to Intuition is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.